This program is brought to you with support from the U.S. EPA. We're here to present the EFC Network podcast. The Environmental Finance Center Network is a partnership of 12 centers serving 10 EPA regions. The EFCN provides training and technical assistance to small water and wastewater systems. This podcast series has been designed to help system personnel improve technical, managerial, and financial capacity of the utilities and communities they serve.
Hi, I'm Mike Tate. I am with the Environmental Finance Center at Wichita State University. And prior to doing this, I worked for about 37, 38 years in the regulatory field. I was 31 years with the state of Kansas and another 6 years with EPA. And prior to that, my educational background, I am an engineer. I got my degrees from Oklahoma State University, a Bachelor of Science in Civil Engineering, and a Master of Science in Bioenvironmental Engineering, and have spent a lot of my career working with smaller communities, in particular smaller communities with lagoons. And I think it's really important to know some of the issues you run into with lagoons, what inspectors tend to find and cite as issues with lagoons. And so we're going to go over that today, and I'm going to give you my top seven things that I have seen in the past typically are found at lagoons that are struggling or having a little bit of problem. So before we jump in on that, though, I would say I'm going to mostly be talking about facultative lagoons, those lagoons that are anaerobic on the bottom, no oxygen, maybe anoxic or a little bit oxygen in the middle, and then aerated in the top part of the lagoon. But still, much of the information that I'm going to give you applies to aerated lagoons also. And I would say that a recent report from EPA shows that about 25% of all publicly owned treatment works or municipal treatment facilities utilize lagoon technology. And they even admit that that's probably an underestimate. So there's lots of lagoons in the country. I'm going to say maybe as many as a third of the treatment plants, one out of every three for a municipality is a lagoon. And they tend to serve smaller rural communities because they provide cost-effective treatment. But there's a few keys to lagoon design that I want to hit first, just so you understand why some of these other things become issues with lagoons. And those kind of key design issues are detention time. And detention time is the most important piece of the puzzle with a lagoon and why it treats wastewater like it does. And detention time is really how much time the water spends in the lagoon system. And the typical is somewhere from 90 to 180 days. So detention time is measured by the volume of a pond, how much water it'll hold, divided by the flow into the pond. And if you work the units out on that, that comes out to days. So detention time is normally expressed in terms of days. The second thing that's important is the organic load or the strength of the waste that goes into the lagoon that's measured as BOD. And typical loading for a facultative lagoon will be somewhere between 20 to 60 pounds per acre. The last thing that is important is the operating depth. And operating depth is somewhere around 5 to 6 feet. And the reason for that is that allows that top part of the lagoon to become aerated by algae and atmospheric transfer of oxygen. Otherwise, if you get too deep, you would probably go anaerobic, become smelly and not treat waste the way you want to. So with that little background on what we typically look at in lagoon design, let's get on to the problematic issues that inspectors often cite. And the first one, and one that is a problem with many lagoons to go out and find, is what's called short circuiting. So short circuiting is when water moves from the influent pipe to a lagoon to the effluent pipe or the transfer pipe to the next cell in a lagoon system without using the full volume of the cell, the full detention. That's called short circuiting. Essentially, the water goes from the influent pipe to the effluent pipe in almost a straight line. Well, how do you know that? Well, sometimes at times a year when the temperature's right, you might even be able to see that plume moving from the influent to the effluent of the lagoon and know that you're getting short circuiting. But on temperature conditions and water temperatures have to all be just right for that to happen. The other way that's pretty simple is you can go grab a bag of oranges at the store and dump them into your influent structure and let them go out into the lagoons and just follow them and watch them where they're floating. And you can determine if you're getting short circuiting, if they go straight from the influent to the effluent. Otherwise, they'll kind of float around and you'll see that the pond is being fully utilized. Now, the thing with short circuiting, there's not really a lot an operator can do operationally to solve that. And that generally involves some type of a construction fix. And that construction fix could be moving the influent line. But before you do that on your own, you always need to contact the state to let them know what you're thinking. And you might need to contact your engineer too. Your engineer may be able to help with that. I have seen some cities who do this on their own with the help of their engineer. They can get out and attach maybe a flexible pipe to the end of the existing line and then extend that, move it, what have you, and weight it down with some external weights and alter the location of that influent line. Another more expensive thing you can do is add what people call curtains, these big pieces of plastic sheets that you would attach on the dikes, the shores of that lagoon. And those curtains then cause the flow pattern to change. Sometimes it'll be flow under the curtain. Sometimes they'll put a hole on one side, but not the other, and it'll force the water to stay in the lagoon until it finds that opening and moves on and exits that particular cell. That is a more expensive fix. It is an engineered solution, so do make sure you contact the state to let them know what you're thinking and contact your engineer on that. Then you could also try to relocate transfer structures. If you have a multi-cell again, you could move those structures, but that's a lot of work. That's probably the least desirable. And if you do something like that, you'd certainly want to contact your state and your engineer. So that's our first issue that we normally see. The second issue, which begins to be a problem that you will see ultimately in almost every lagoon, is sludge accumulation. That's the biosolids or the dead cells that accumulate in the bottom of the lagoon. So, I already told you that detention time is a primary design value for treatment. So, if you significantly reduce that detention time, your treatment will suffer. Well, how can you reduce it? Well, if you fill up the bottom of your lagoon with biosolids and not the water that you're trying to treat, excuse me, you'll lose volume in that lagoon and that will cause the detention time to go down. So you ask yourself, well, how much is too much sludge in the bottom of a lagoon? I normally say my rule of thumb is when you measure the sludge, which we'll talk about in a minute, if you're at around 18 inches of sludge, you probably ought to start planning on removal within the next year, two, three, four, 5 years, something like that. And I kind of base that on the fact there's a design standard out there that's called the 10 state standards, which is a group of 10 states who get together kind of in the Mississippi River Basin. And it calls for 90 to 120 days of detention in a lagoon. Yeah, I can say 90 represents about 25% of 120. So I would say for sure at 25% detention time lost, you ought to be sludging. So how do you know that you've got that much sludge in your lagoon? Well, you need to measure the depth of the sludge in each lagoon. And you can do that with what's called a sludge judge. If you're not familiar with a sludge judge, it's pretty simple. It's a clear plastic pipe that's probably about 15 feet long. It's got marked with graduations, typically in a foot, maybe 6 inches. And it has what's called a foot valve on it, so that if you poke that pipe from a boat, you got to be out in a lagoon, so you need to be in a boat, and you poke it down to the bottom of the lagoon. When you pull it up, that foot valve closes, and you can pull it up, and then you can see the depth of the sludge that's in that pipe, and that gives you your depth. That's, I think, how most people do it. There are some electronic devices out there that you lower down till they touch the top of that sludge blanket, and it'll complete a circuit and give you a value. There's also people who've been experimenting, and I've seen pretty good success with sonar, really just like a fish locator. And some of the new fish locators are pretty sensitive and can find you the bottom depth of that lagoon, which is really the sludge blanket. And that can be used. But it's not just going out and poking that down once and finding a value. You really need to set up a grid on your lagoon. And you can do that on shore. You could put up cones, say, on the dikes of your lagoons on all four sides. As you go out in your boat, you can line up on those various points. And I would say you probably ought to have 20 or more. And you want to stop at that point and you want to measure the depth. Good to have a second person with you who can then record the location and the depth of that sludge at that one point. You can kind of think of it like a tic-tac-toe board, you know, where each of those lines intersects. You want to find the depth of the sludge at that point. So then once you have all of those depths located on that grid, you can go back and you can find the average depth of the sludge in that lagoon. And that's what we'd call, you know, the depth of the sludge in that particular cell. Then you have to calculate, you know, the volume of that sludge, and you have to calculate the volume of the lagoon at the water depth it's operating at. And you can then divide the sludge volume by the total volume of the lagoon, and you can get your detention time loss. So it's kind of an odd shape to measure. It's not one you typically see a formula for, because if you think about that lagoon, the sides are sloped, the bottom's smaller than the top, and it's really what's called an obelisk. And again, that calculation's not always easy to find, but we have put a calculator out on the Wichita State Environmental Finance Center website that will help you. If you can collect the top area, get your sludge depth, get your water depth that you're operating at, it can help you then calculate that detention loss just with that data. And I will say, if you don't have plans and specs to get that data from, you can pretty well, at least for that top area of the lagoon, you can use Google Earth or Google Maps and call up your lagoon system. And there's a way on that to then measure the size of that lagoon. So you can get those top widths and lengths of each cell and calculate that. And then when you do that for each cell, you calculate that detention time loss and look and see how much loss you have in your detention times. And again, you're looking for something less than 25%. Once you get up to 25%, then you probably ought to be desludging. Now, this isn't an every year thing typically that you do, because it usually takes, you know, what we've seen is about 20 years or more to build up enough sludge that it begins to be time to desludge. So I would say probably you'd want to start measuring, take a sludge depth at about 15 years and see where you're at. And based on that, then maybe every 1 to 5 years thereafter, you can take a sludge depth and see where you're at in terms of that. But if you begin to see it getting up there to 18, 19, 20%, I'd be sure to start thinking about trying to save some money, set some money back for the desludging process. Because desludging is probably the costliest thing you can do in terms of maintenance at a lagoon. So it's good to set aside that money to plan for the future. And the cost of that's going to depend on the lagoon size, the amount of sludge you have, and your disposal method. And there's always also a fee from commercial folks, you know, just to mobilize, just to get all of their equipment out on site. So it's not something you want to just do and do part way. You want to have this planned out. You want to make sure you get the maximum amount of sludge out each time you have to do that. Now, if you are able to, land application is a good way to deal with that sludge. It's got some nutrient value, and it will allow you to cut down on your costs typically. And if you got farm ground that's really close to your lagoon where you could apply it, then your costs go down significantly. I've seen some places where people have been able to pump sludge directly from a lagoon to a tractor that's pulling an injector at a field next door or very close. And they just pump and inject sludge, and that really saves then on hauling costs. Because if you have to start hauling sludge, that becomes more expensive. Most people will usually hire a contractor to do all of the work in terms of desludging. They'll desludge and they'll do the disposal or land application. And that land application requires compliance with what is called Part 503 of the federal regulations. It's 40 Code of Federal Regulations, Part 503. And that just limits how much biosolid or sludge that you can apply to a parcel of land. And contractors are really good generally at helping you comply with those aspects too. But what they're looking at is if they have to haul a long distance to get rid of that sludge, be it in a landfill or for land application, they may want to bring in dewatering equipment. When you're talking about sludge, you're talking about, gosh, maybe 95, 96% water and 4%, 5% solids. And so they might bring in dewatering equipment because that added weight and volume of the water makes your hauling costs go way up. You know, who wants to haul water when you're really wanting to get rid of the solids? So a lot of times contractors will look at dewatering, which they are going to have to do if you go to a landfill, or if their costs for hauling a long distance are high, they may want to dewater and haul more drier solids to apply to the land. But lastly, while I've talked about contractors doing that, I have seen a few small cities do the work on their own. May not be something I'd advise everybody to do, but have seen some pretty creative things where one city constructed their own barge, just made a platform, and they used barrels for floats to hold a suction line, which they ran to the bottom of the lagoon. And then the suction line is connected to a pump on shore to essentially kind of vacuum the sludge out. And if you're out rural, the one I saw was somebody actually used a manure pump connected to the power takeoff on their tractor and used that as the source to pump sludge out of the lagoon and either onto a field or into a little holding cell where they would land apply later. So solids, it's a big deal. It's costly. But fortunately, it only has to be done every 20 years or more. So something you need to think about as your lagoon is aging. Kind of the third thing then that we'll see a lot, go out and inspect a lagoon, is just maintenance. A lot of people think they're out there and they can just let them go, which really isn't the case. And there are some really pretty simple things involved with some of the maintenance that you need to take care of. First one you'll always hear is mow the weeds. You don't want a lot of tall weeds around the water's edge. That draws pests that you don't want around there. Plus, it'll block the airflow, the air blowing across those lagoons, which help mix oxygen into the water. And so you really don't want those around the edge. You also don't want trees, and trees you don't want for a couple of reasons. They'll block the airflow, so you want that airflow across the lagoon as you do by trimming weeds. But you can also, if you get trees growing into the dikes of a lagoon, those tree roots can undermine the dikes, and they can cause those dikes to begin to give out if they become too entangled with roots. And that kind of falls into what I call dike integrity, keeping those dikes in good condition. You'll sometimes see dike sloughing, we call it. The soil on the inside of the dike just sloughing off into the lagoon. And if that happens, they're usually a pretty fairly flat slope, like 3-to-1, 4-to-1 slopes on those dikes. And that does make it easy to run a tractor down with a brush hog or a side cutter to trim weeds and all down along the lagoon. But if those dikes slough off and you begin to get more vertical on those dikes, then it makes it very hard to maintain that vegetation on them. The other thing you might find on dike integrity is burrowing animals. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about that later. And then the other maintenance thing, which you'll often see, is most every state's going to have rules that say you need to have fencing around the lagoon and signage to warn people that this is a lagoon and that it is not to be thought of as a swimming hole or a place to fish. So you always need to maintain that fencing and the signage around your lagoon. Okay, the fourth issue that we normally see is organic overload. And that's when a higher strength waste than designed, usually measured in terms of BOD or biochemical oxygen demand, is higher than the design. And recall that design is around 20 to 60 pounds per acre. So a tip for you is just to get a kind of a feel, rule of thumbish, if you will, kind of thing, is that a person typically contributes 0.17 pounds per person per day of BOD. So I'm going to pick my design load at 34 pounds per acre, which falls within that range. And so when I divide 34 by 0.17, that comes out to 200 people. So 200 people per acre is kind of a good rule of thumb. If you know you got more people than that, maybe that's a problem with your organic overload. But generally, what you get is that it is industry related. And sometimes you can have domestic related. I've seen it once or twice where a facility has been designed and then they're receiving waste from low flow conservation type designs on the wastewater side. So very low flow toilets, low flow fixtures, and they're conserving water. So there's less water to dilute that waste coming down the pipe. So it's higher strength than what the facility planned on. Again, that's pretty rare, but it can happen. Most of it is, again, associated with industry. And in Kansas, we would see a lot of it with food processing industry. We'd have small meat processors that were hooked to the sewer, and they may only slaughter a few head a week and maybe just one day a week. But during that one day, if they didn't catch their waste, it could really impact the lagoon. I have seen times when the influent runs to red or pinkish color for short periods just because of blood from that meatpacking facility. So be cautious of that. We've also seen some things with food processors of any type that tend to put out a higher strength waste than what the facility was designed for if it were just getting waste from homes and residences, those types of things that you'd normally see. The other thing is septic haulers, waste haulers, people bringing in porta potty waste. Those can sometimes be pretty high strength. A lot of times those are legitimate haulers that you know about who are paying you to dump those wastes at your facility. But sometimes I'd caution you, you get what we would call midnight dumpers, people who were illegally dumping waste into the system. And we actually had a case one time when I was working with the state where an industrial waste hauler just pulled up with his tank and dumped it all into the bay of a car wash drain that really went and upset the facility. So you kind of got those things to watch out for too. The next piece that you'll see fairly often, next issue, is hydraulic overloading. And that means that the flow rates are greater than what the facility was designed for. So you got to recall that I said the primary design factor for a lagoon is its detention time. And since detention times calculated by the volume divided by the flow rate, as that flow rate increases, you're dividing by a larger number. So that means your detention time is going to decrease, and thus your treatment may suffer. Now, for these municipal types of systems, it's almost always caused by infiltration inflow, INI. And that's where you've got a leaky sewer system. It can leak in the manholes. It can leak in the sewer lines. And that can cause quite a bit of problem. You'll see it particularly when you're in an area with high groundwater, and that groundwater gets into your collection system and just adds a lot more water than what you were planning on. So there's really a couple of ways to fix that, and that is to patch up the sewer lines and the manholes, or to build more volume, another cell perhaps, to bring your detention time back to where you want it to be. And that's generally referred to as transport and treat. Just go ahead and let it be leaky and send it down and just add more treatment. But I look at that as treating as being a pretty short-term fix, but sometimes you need to do it for the short term while you go back and look at and work on fixing your collection system. Your collection system will only get worse over time if it's not repaired. So what you might do is build more volume for the short term just to give yourself time to fix the leaky sewers and manholes. Because when you start doing that, that's usually a years long or even decades long task, depending on the size of your collection system. Kind of the last reason you can have the hydraulic overloading, which would also bring about organic overloading, is if you just have too many connections to the system. You know, you might have a town that the lagoon was initially designed for 500 people, and it's a growing town. It now has 600 people. So, of course, you know, the detention time is going to be down, it's going to be getting more organic load too than what it was ever designed for. So that can be an issue. The sixth item that I typically see is wildlife issues. Burrowing animals can undermine dikes and eventually cause them to collapse or and even breach. Breach means, you know, you get a notch in it and the water can run out of the lagoon. And a lot of people, you know, they've seen that and they've seen the animals, but they've never really seen a problem. I have, and it can really happen that they can cause those lagoon dikes to fail and lose water. And so with those burrowing type animals, you normally need to work with your state wildlife agency to rid the lagoon of the animals. Sometimes they'll trap and move somewhere else. Other times they may trap and use their pelt to recoup some money from that. But if you do that, you've got to work with a licensed trapper who the wildlife agency has licensed or approved. And it's interesting, the agency I used to work for had an employee who was a trapper just as a side job. And he would oftentimes, when there were those issues, he would trap them and then sell the pelts to cover his expenses for doing that. You also get animals that chew through an exposed plastic liner. If you have a plastic liner on your lagoon instead of just soil, for some reason, I've heard that some of them use a soybean oil in the liner material. And so those animals will chew through that plastic liner and leave holes. And you don't want a liner to have a hole in it. If, you know, the water gets up and gets behind that, that'll start eroding the soil and causing that dike to fail. So the best designs will cover the plastic with soil and then some big riprap, you know, heavy 4-inch or more sized rock that you'll put on to cover that. And that should keep them from getting down there even to the liner. But if you do have exposed liner at the top and it gets chewed through, you need to be sure and patch that liner. And last but not least are turtles. And turtles are notorious for establishing themselves in the transfer pipes between lagoons. Those, I've seen them, I think as small as 4 inches, maybe 4-8 inches in those. And turtles can get inside there and grow. And if they grow enough, they can get stuck in those pipes and then obstruct flow, become a real mess. And then you have to get down there with some kind of rotting equipment or cleaning equipment to remove them. And that's generally a pain because you're generally have to be out on the water and trying to work that equipment back through the transfer pipe. So what you'd like to do is make sure those pipes are screened so that the animals can't get in to begin with. And some structures have those built in. Most good designers will have, I've seen cast iron grates put in that are bolted on each side or stainless steel. But I've also seen people have had to go back after the fact that if there's enough pipe sticking out there, they'll use some stainless steel mesh and pull that over the pipe and then clamp it down with a stainless steel clamp. And that should be enough to keep the turtles from entering those pipes and causing a problem. So last but not least, number 7 on the list is monitoring and record keeping. And this can really apply to about any kind of facility. But often when you get inspected, inspectors may cite some of these things as deficiencies. So you need to be aware of them. And the first is that you're required to collect samples if you discharge even once during the monitoring period. Even if your monitoring period is a month or a quarter and you discharge, you should be collecting a sample and analyzing it. And people who've run facultative lagoons will know that a lot of times they don't discharge all days during the month or during the quarter, but if they do, you still have to sample. You know, what we saw a lot was that Lagoon's just turned their sample collection and analyzing over to commercial labs. And so those commercial labs, to make that worth their while and make it financially worthwhile, would go out and run a route to each lagoon. They call it a milk run. So they might only show up at your facility one time a month or quarter. You know, it might be every third Tuesday at 11 a.m. And if it wasn't discharging, if that lagoon wasn't discharging at 11 a.m. that third Tuesday, they'd say, no discharge, we're not taking a sample. Well, if you discharge any other time, though, during that monitoring period, you are responsible for collecting and analyzing a sample if it discharges. And we have seen that before, where people will report no discharge on their discharge monitoring report that you send to the state. And the inspector may have been out sometime during that month and clearly saw a discharge. So you need to be able to work out something with your lab that's doing analyzing. If you're discharging during that month, it may be that you need to discharge it and get the sample to the lab during that reporting period. But at the same time, I would caution you to avoid dipping a sample or telling your commercial lab to dip a sample. And what I mean by that is sometimes if there's no discharge, they go out and dip a sample out of the top of the lagoon. That may not give accurate results. That's really not representative of what might be discharged out of the pipe. So I would advise you against that. The other thing with lagoons, we all know they grow algae. That's part of what makes them work. So you want to avoid having a big chunk of algae in your effluent sample. That's really not representative of what's going on at your lagoon, and it may provide inaccurate results. So really try to avoid getting those big hunks of algae in your sample. And then the thing that you'll often see, and I see EPA inspectors cite this more so than state inspectors, is on pH and pH sampling. pH samples are supposed to be analyzed within 15 minutes of collection. So how do you do that? Well, you really need an on-site lab if you're going to do it within 15 minutes. And sometimes it's difficult to justify having an on-site lab for a lagoon in a small community, particularly if a state requires any results to be submitted by a certified lab. And then that would mean the city would have to get their lab certified just for doing pH. And that can be pretty onerous. But something I learned later in my career that I'd provide as a tip that you could talk to your regulatory agency about is that even though the secondary treatment requirements, typically people believe they say you've got a sample for BOD, total suspended solids, and pH, there is an exception for pH in the secondary treatment rule, which is in the Code of Federal Regulations at Title 40, Part 133.102C. That's a mouthful. But anyway, let me read that to you real quick. It says pH, the effluent values for pH shall be maintained within the limits of 6 to 9 unless the publicly owned treatment work demonstrates that 1, organic chemicals are not added to the waste stream as a part of the treatment, and contributions from industrial sources do not cause the effluent to be less than 6 or greater than 9. So basically what that's saying is you really don't need to have a pH limit on your lagoon if you don't have industries that contribute acids or caustics that would cause the pH to go up or down, nor do you add any chemicals to your wastewater as a part of the treatment that would cause it to go up or down. It says you really don't need a pH limit. So if you're having troubles with somebody citing you on pH and the fact that you're not getting it sampled within 15 or analyzed within 15 minutes of sampling, you might look and see with your state if they'd be willing to work with you on that. If you are a small town and you don't have industry that's contributing acids and bases and you're not doing it yourself. The next thing in terms of record keeping, that sometimes you run into a problem, an inspector will go out and ask for the records and nobody can provide them to them. You know, perhaps they were with the city clerk and that person isn't working that day and don't know where the records are. Well, that didn't really cut it because, again, the federal regulations that the states are required to adopt require you to have access to those records if asked for. It also says that the regulatory agency has a right to enter and inspect your facility at reasonable hours. So typically during the working day, they come into your facility. And if they do, they can ask for those records and they should be provided to them. They says have access to copy at reasonable times and review those records. So you need to have your records available where you know they're at, where you know you can get them. If that requires making duplicate copies that the city clerk may keep the official copy for the city, but if you have a city shop or a public works building or some other place where the operators congregate, you ought to keep a set of records there too so that that operator can always have access to them when inspected by either the state or EPA. So with that, that's about it. Those are my seven common issues I see with lagoons and lagoon operations. And I appreciate your listening to this podcast today. Thanks.
Thank you to all our listeners for tuning into this episode of the EFC Network Podcast, brought to you with support from the US EPA. Be sure to stay tuned for future EFC Network podcast episodes.